Well, hello and welcome, listeners and Patreon subscribers, to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground, right here in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and as usual, I am joined by the awesome friend of mine from the Western Coast, Mr. Alex Hogg. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. Now, as Hoggy mentioned in the previous episode, these two episodes have actually been recorded back to back. Interesting. But this particular...
I wait in eager anticipation for the giant news story that will completely derail this recording and force us to record something on the fly.
Yeah, this particular episode, the last episode, we were kind of focusing mostly on new stuff that was coming out in Australia and so on and so forth. This particular episode, we're going to focus more on stuff that was happening internationally. Now, we should probably start with a bit of follow-up. You know, first things first, John Petrucci interview, which I was fortunate enough to do. John was very gracious with his time and so on and so forth. What did you think? I mean, just out of curiosity, I mean, you listened to the interview this morning. So was there anything that particularly stood out for you?
I'd be very interested to hear more. And we're probably going to have to do this next time Dream Theater have a record to come out. We're going to have to definitely do like a deep dive, some sort of like lyric writing masterclass with John Petrucci.
Yeah. Yeah. That like, was really interesting.
It is. I mean, we all know who he was influenced by, you know, with lyrics, you know, as a musician growing up. Very influential. He obviously name checked Neil Peart there. Obviously Neil Peart's a big influence. Mm-hmm. John Anderson is a big influence. And the last time I met him, I asked him, I was like, oh, what about some other ones? And he name checked the usual sort of prog suspects. Peter Gabriel, Pete Townsend, Roger Waters. I just happened to be wearing a Marillion t-shirt that day. So he says, oh yeah, and Fish. You know, he's a big Fish was a big influence. Mm. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to know who now is he listening to that like and sort of thinking about lyrics and who not necessarily who does it well, but who sort of influences him to try to think about lyric writing in a different way.
I often wonder about that myself. I mean, I am a terrible lyricist. There is a reason why I get other people to write lyrics for me. I'm just atrocious at it. Things always come out gamey and weird.
But that's no slight on you, Dave. There are plenty of great musicians who can't write a lyric to save their life.
Oh, I'm not suggesting
Elton John, for example. That's why he worked with Bernie Taupin.
Well, I mean, I'm not suggesting I'm you know a great musician either, but you know,
there's definitely a there are definitely musicians that have the preference.
Yes, 100%.
Like Neil Peart was a fantastic lyricist.
Yes,
wasn't necessarily that he wasn't interested in writing the music,
yeah.
Whereas Geddy and Alex were very good at writing music, could write lyrics and did write some rather nice lyrics, but Neil was definitely the better lyricist out of the three of them.
100%.
So everybody sort of finds their own, and it's definitely sort of panning out that way in Dream Theater. Yes, there are lyrical contributions from other members of the band. James LeBrie writes lyrics every now and then. John Myung has his lyrics. Mike Mangini is now starting to write lyrics. But definitely John is kind of the main lyric writer in the band now. Certainly after Kevin and then Kevin Moore and then Mike Portnoy left, the lyric writing has definitely sort of fallen mostly on his shoulders.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's... I quite like it, you know, and I think it would be a really, really interesting thing to hear his take on how he approaches it and, you know, maybe how he approaches what would be actually a really interesting thing to hear about would be how he approaches controversial subjects as well.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because the controversial ones seem to come mostly from the pen of James LeBrie. I mean, Sacrifice Sons, Prophets of War... Those are both James's.
Yes.
And then I guess you've got like Outcry and The Great Debate, which are
both
political
Petrucci
songs.
Lyrics, yeah.
They are both John's lyrics, yeah.
Yeah.
The other members of the band, when they do write lyrics, don't tend to be overtly political. Most of them deal with like sort of personal things.
Mm.
or in the case of, mostly like personal sort of topics and things. So, yeah, I'd be very interested to hear that episode, and given that we're the ones who came up with it, we're probably the ones who should do it.
Yes, yeah. I think it would
We'd probably need to get, like, I don't know, a good 2 hours out of him to go through everything, I guess.
Maybe, I don't know. John, if you're listening, can we have 2 hours of your time? And we'll get up early in the morning this time around. Because it'll be really early in the morning for me and not so early in the morning for him.
That involves us being awake at fucking 2 a.m. to have it happen, so be it.
Exactly, exactly.
Anyway, the next piece of follow-up that we have isn't just a follow-up from us, but it was an interview that John Petrucci did on the Prog Report.
Mm.
And it's something that he mentioned in the interview that you did, in that the physical streaming of the record is out now as of time of recording, but the physical release won't be out until later on. And somehow there was the idea that this was like a new or novel concept, and it just isn't.
No.
This happens. I mean, it makes sense that if you're going to release a record, and especially in the world circumstance that we have now with like delayed shipping and postponement of physical releases of various things because of shipping, see our last conversation in the previous episode where we ranted long and hard about shipping. It makes sense to have, and when you have a distribution system, streaming, for example, where you can put the thing out now for everyone to hear. And also, like, streaming seems to be the preferred medium over, say, a digital download, because the second you have a digital download, within 5 minutes of the code going out, it's up on the torrent sites.
Yes, that's right.
So if you stream it, then the artist is getting paid in giant inverted commas, and you're not having to deal with, like, it being leaked onto, you know, the torrent sites.
That's right.
People who want to hear it can click on the thing and listen to it, and the artist can receive the 0.0039 cents for it.
That's right. I thought it was a bit odd that they mentioned that it was, you know, an unusual way to do it. Maybe it's unusual for bigger bands and people that are
possibly
sort of higher up and so on and so forth. But for, you know, the rest of us plebs down in the trenches, it's pretty normal. And yeah, 100%, it makes perfect sense.
Even the concept of a physical release is starting to become a little bit less common. There are plenty of bands that we know and amongst the scene here that don't seem to bother with shipping CDs at all.
That's right.
It's like, here is our Bandcamp, pay us and we'll send you a download. You know, you don't have to then worry about trying to chip CDs and being that band that's got a garage full or stuff in the basement full of, like, unsold CDs.
That's
you just
right.
don't have that. It's all there, and you pay and you get the physical, you get something that you can say is yours without having to deal with all the physical product.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's becoming, and then you've got these people who will not be doing, for example, CDs, but they might do a limited run of vinyl.
Yes.
You know, and then that becomes sort of a collector's item and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
so.
Or even like just stuff from the back catalogue as well tends to end up on vinyl too, if it's of the right length, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. But either which way, I think that's about it for follow-up.
Yes. So we'll jump into the news. So Fate Warning have announced that they have a new album on the way out. This album will be called Long Day Good Night. It'll be coming out November 6th on Metal Blade Records. The lead-off single in service of this record, however, is called Scars.
Yes.
Now, have you had a chance to listen to this one, Dave?
I did. I had a listen to it on my run this afternoon, and it was awesome. It was really, really, really good. There's a lot packed into 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah. This song is very quintessential Fate's Warning. Like, you're getting exactly what it is. This is a Fate's Warning record. This is what in the same way that John Petrucci, I think, did this with Terminal Velocity, where it's like the lead-off single is like the safe one. I think Fate's Warning have done exactly the same thing here too.
I mean, if that's the safe one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if that's the safe one, heaven help the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's very technical, very progressive, but still has a great melody going through it. This is the thing about Fate's Warning that kind of pissed me off, is that everybody talks about Dream Theater. Everybody talks about Queensryche as like the 1990s titans of prog metal. But the bottom line is that this band have been doing this far before Dream Theater and Queensryche came into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
These guys have been doing this stuff since like the early 80s.
Yeah, I mean, these guys...
That's not just me talking as well. I mean, Mike Portnoy said the same thing too. He's like, everybody thinks of Dream Theater as like the prog metal people, but Fate's Warning were doing this far before we started it.
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of the unsung heroes of it, aren't they?
Very much so, very much so. Yeah. Jim Matheos and Jerry Vera, those guys are fantastic players, and it always sort of bugged me that they never got like the commercial success and recognition that other bigger prog metal bands did.
Absolutely. I think I read somewhere as well that they're going against the sort of the grain, which instead of the record being shorter, it's going to be like fucking 70 minutes or something.
Yeah. If you look at the track listing online for this record, it's basically a full CD. There's no like trimming it to like 45 minutes to fit on a vinyl thing that is becoming the trend over the last couple of years. This is full on, all out. This is a full on CD release size record. Awesome. Which if they pull it off and there's no like flab or sort of extra songs that probably didn't need to be there, then that is rather impressive, frankly.
Absolutely. I'm really keen for it, and I'm definitely going to be putting a pin in it and, you know, having a good listen to it when it does come out in early November there.
Absolutely.
It's going to be a hell of a lot of fun.
Now, switching gears to the other end of the prog spectrum, in our definition of the prog spectrum, for those of you who may be a little bit more newer to the show, we have the American-driven kind of prog metal, and then we've got the sort of European kind of classic prog stuff, influence, you know, Yes, Genesis, ELP, that kind of thing. Mm. Now, this band is out of Norway. They are called Wobbler.
Huh.
And they are releasing a new record very shortly called Dwellers of the Deep on October the 23rd. Now, there is at time of recording, there is no lead-off single available to listen to this, but there probably won't be because the track listing only comes up with 4 songs.
Interesting.
So I suspect we're going to get the complete opposite, where we have, with Fate's Warning, we have a 72-minute record. Mm. This one, we're going to have 4 songs, and they're more or less going to be geared towards kind of that vinyl sort of thing, maybe 10, 15-minute songs each or something, possibly. I'm not sure. Only the titles are available at the moment. There is no sort of name the sort of time listings for that yet.
Absolutely.
However, they do tend to follow very much in that sort of Yes, Genesis kind of sound, but it's not just a retread. We're not talking like retro sort of prog rock here. They're definitely taking it into a newer modern kind of direction. They're a very interesting band, and we'll put a link in the show notes to some of their music. You can kind of have a listen to it, and you know, if you like that kind of music, this is probably a newer band you may not have heard of that might be up your alley.
Absolutely. It sounds like something that would definitely be worth a listen for myself as well. So I might go and jump in on these guys because I have not heard of them before. So there you go.
All right.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the end of the news. Mm. So we're not going to keep you waiting too much longer. We are going to jump into the main topic. John Petrucci's brand new solo album, Terminal Velocity.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Good. Now, this solo album has been, you know, I don't think there's been an interview that John Petrucci has done in probably the last 10 years where someone hasn't asked him about a solo record.
Yep.
And he's been saying, oh, it's coming, it's happening, I've got some stuff, been working on it, da da da. Well, here we are. 15 years after he released the first one, we've got the second one.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're going to go track by track on this record right now.
Absolutely.
Now, the first song, Terminal Velocity, we have spoken about at length in a previous episode. We'll throw a link in the show notes to our discussion about that.
We have. One thing I do want to bring up, though, is that for those of you who haven't listened to the John Petrucci interview, go and listen to it because we talk about a couple of things to do with, obviously, the album and all that sort of stuff. But one thing that I wanted to know in particular about this album was, where did the actual name of the album come from? You know, was it a tongue-in-cheek reference to the Velocity album, etc.? Turns out it wasn't.
You may need to explain what we mean by the Velocity album.
So Distance Over Time, the latest Dream Theater album, Distance Over Time is a mathematical formula that is velocity. That's what it is.
Yes.
So everyone started calling it the Velocity album. So I actually asked John, you know, is it a reference to the speed of your fingers, or is it a cheek, tongue-in-cheek reference to the fact that everyone was calling your last album Velocity, you know? And he said a couple of really interesting things. The first thing he said was, well, the original name of the latest Dream Theater album, Distance Over Time, was actually going to be Velocity. But they thought that sounded not Dream Theater enough, so they went with Distance Over Time. And secondly, the actual title of this album comes from a conversation he actually had with his son, because he was saying to his son, hey, you know, what's that? Because they were talking about the speed that he was playing at and such. And he said, what's that term, you know, when something's falling and it can't fall any faster. And his son said, you mean terminal velocity? He's like, oh yeah, that's a good one. And wrote that down. So that's where the actual name of this song came from, and also the name of the album, as it happened. So, you know, really interesting little tidbit of information that I was pleasantly surprised about.
Absolutely.
But you are right. We have discussed this particular track at length on a previous episode.
Baby Yoda and all, yes.
Yes, Baby Yoda and all.
it was the lead-off single for the record. It was, like, the safe one, I guess, in that. If you were to say, oh, John Petrucci has released a solo album, this is the song you would kind of expect to hear.
Mm.
You know, all of the great John Petrucci hallmarks are all here in this song. Mike Portnoy's drumming is obviously there as well, something that you spoke at length with him about on the interview as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're all there, and we're going to put a link in the show notes to our discussion about that song so you can... You can have a listen to us talking about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And introduce even more people to Baby Yoda.
Oh, God.
We'll move straight forward then into The Odd Father.
Yes.
So when we get to this song, it's like, aha, now we're getting into like the real sort of interesting, more progressive parts of the record. It starts off sounding a bit like post-rock, but then moves into slightly more conventional territory for John Petrucci.
Yes.
This intro also sounds kind of similar to a small fragment from John Petrucci's 1995 home video Rock Discipline. Now, this DVD is going to come up quite a bit on this show.
Mm.
There are various little snippets and pieces from this record that have obviously been developed and worked further into this album.
Yes.
Now, the video itself is well and truly out of print. I've got a copy of it, though, and it can be found secondhand on Amazon. Ah, you've got one as well.
Yeah, it was my bloody Bible for learning guitar, like 10, 15 years ago.
It is. I discovered it while I was at university, actually, and most of the like warm-up exercises were very helpful for me when I was doing university exams, because I had debilitating writer's cramp during that whole time, and so I would use a lot of those warm-up exercises for that.
Mm, there you go.
You can find it secondhand on Amazon, and if you look hard enough in the right places, you can find it on YouTube as well,
yes,
if you wish.
You can. You can also find a very, very funny piss take of it by a guy called Adam O2, who basically...
Oh, is that the one who was like...
Who mimics Petrucci over his voice?
You've got to do this so you can play 40,000 notes a second and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, just put your guitar down. Look at this guitar, it's beautiful. It was painted by Michelangelo, not that guitar noob, you know, the guy that painted like Jesus on the ceiling.
Hilarious. It was referred on the Chaos in Motion
World Tour DVD. That's right. Yeah.
He had like these little pads on his arm.
Yeah.
And he was asking, oh, it's really cold outside. And Portnoy's in the background going, come on, man. You gotta talk like the YouTube guy.
Yeah.
And then Petrucci references it. You know, when you gotta pick it 25,000 notes a minute, like I do, you need to have your arm at exactly 78 degrees, otherwise it doesn't work.
It's actually really funny. It's awesome.
Yeah.
This particular track, you're right. There were a couple of little, I think, more subtle nods than another one we'll come up with in a minute, to Rock Discipline. Interestingly, he actually mentioned in another interview, not the one that we did, but another interview he did for the Prog Report, that The Odd Father is actually a reference to a mafia mobster, Italian mobster, mafia guy from the Genovese crime family, who was around in, oh God, I'm not quite sure actually. He was around, I think he died in like 2005 or something. But his other name was The Chin, which was actually the original title of this track was The Chin. And then he found out, John found out that he was related to him somehow, or his wife was related to him or something, which was hilarious. And then he sort of said, oh yeah, the other name of this guy is like, oh, the Robe and, you know, the real boss of New York and blah, and then the Odd Father. And everyone was like, Mike, I'm assuming Mike Portnoy in particular was like, that's the name, the Odd Father. That's way better than The Chin, you know? So, yeah. I think it's a really, really interesting little tidbit of information, as to how the track came to be. But, you know, when I was saying the last time when we were mentioning, this particular album and the first track came out and we kind of reviewed the first track, I was like, I hope the rest of the album isn't like this, you know, this doesn't seem, but then again, like Petrucci, you know, maybe he's released the safe track, and by God, did he release the safe track.
Yeah.
The Odd Father is full of everything that you would expect from Petrucci, just heavy and technical and pants shittingly terrifying to try and learn. So, you know, it's amazing. It's really, and that's pretty much, that is the rest of this album. Pants shittingly terrifying trying to learn it. That sums up this album, I think.
I feel like we should put that as the title for this particular episode. I think,
I'm fine
track
with that.
Track by track on John Petrucci's Terminal Velocity. Mm. Pants shittingly terrifying to learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
There we go. We got the title for the episode, Dave. Well on us. So we move on to the next song, the happy song. Now, when we were talking about this off air, you mentioned that this could be like a pop rock song.
Yeah.
What sort of like pop radio station in a bizarro alternate universe would play this song?
I think from memory it was before I'd heard the album.
Aha.
From memory. Because I looked at the title and I was like, happy song. Okay, yeah, it could be like a, you know, maybe it's like a pop rocky kind of thing. I don't know. There are definite pop rock moments in it where it sounds like he's kind of channeling that early 2000s, you know, I don't know a band, it's not coming to my head, Jimmy Eat World and sort of those sorts of dudes, sort of around the 30 second mark. It's like, it's na 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 da 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 da, you know, Scotty Doesn't Know kind of thing. That's exactly what it is, actually. It's totally Scotty Doesn't Know. You know, and it's really cool. Like, I don't know if he's meaning to do it, but it's remarkably interesting that that's what it is. But then you've just got all the usual shreddy kind of crazy sweeping stuff that he does as well. One thing that John is extremely good at is blending those particular styles and blending stuff that is extremely pleasant to the ear to listen to. It's not just, you know, chuggy kind of stuff, although he does that very well. He has this very unique ability to play crazy technical stuff that you listen to and you go, that is so cool to hear. You know, it just puts a smile on your dial. And I'm assuming that's why he called it the happy song.
Probably. There is a certain part to the melody that does feel kind of, I don't know, major key. It probably isn't, but.
No, the whole song I think is done in major key. I think you're right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No, okay.
You know,
I have to defer to your greater knowledge on that one, Dave. But it just sounds kind of happy, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is probably where the name came from.
But I would suggest so.
Yeah.
There's also a section I do want to mention as well, right at the end of the song, like in the last sort of 30 seconds, where he's doing that sweeping thing, which is that main riff, right? And then he harmonizes it.
Mm.
And it is incredible. From a guitarist perspective, to hear him pull that off. I mean, if anyone's going to pull it off, it's going to be him, right? But, I mean, wow. Yeah, it's just, I really want to learn this whole song. I really want to learn it, but I also know that I'm probably going to spend the next, like, 6 months trying to learn it and then give up in frustration.
How's Bastard Warrior coming along, Dave?
Done.
done.
Actually got it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Good stuff.
Yeah.
If only Dream Theater did like a swap the band sort of thing, although I suspect you'd probably end up with like 40,000 people auditioning to be the guitar player and nothing for anybody else.
And probably 39,999 people who are much better than me.
Yeah, people who, you know, have spent, you know, went to music college and done the whole bit and all the rest of it. Yeah,
100%. Not just some semi-self-talk schmuck like myself. But it's a great track, happy song. Moving on to the next track, Gemini. Now,
when I first heard this, I'm like, yeah, I've heard this before. Went and pulled up the Rock Discipline DVD. I'm like, aha, there it is. I knew I'd heard this before. The opening riff, the first guitar solo, and the outro, which is just the opening riff again, are all from that home video, Rock Discipline.
Interestingly.
And this is where I heard that, and I'm like, that you have to ask him, where did that come from? I'm not going mad. This really did come from the thing.
Yeah. And interestingly, he confirmed that. He did say, yes, it did come from that era. It actually came from before that Rock Discipline DVD was around. It was like from the time that he was doing like clinics and such. He'd just take a little, like a little sequencer thing and just, you know, do guitar exercises and such over it, and just play stuff and show people what he was doing and everything, which is really cool. And then he said in the interview that I did with him, he said, you know, I always wanted to make it into a full-fledged song. So he did. And that's what Gemini has become.
You could definitely tell the different eras, though. There's that opening part, which that opening part definitely sounds very Awake era.
It totally does.
Like, definitely that, where he would have, like, he just got into the 7-string and he was using an Ibanez and all that. And then you can tell when that bit stops and then it cuts into like modern John.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, the new style and the new guitar tones and all that sort of stuff. It's all there. And then it goes back to like old John, so to speak. Modern John and old John, you know.
This particular section, and there's a section around about the minute mark where it does like a dooga digga dooga digga dooga digga dooga digga, which is the bit you're talking about from Rock Discipline. But you can definitely feel that 90s part of him coming through in that, you know, which is totally great. Yeah. It's that in between Awake and Falling Into Infinity period of Petrucci's playing. Which I think is awesome. It's great to actually hear him doing that stuff.
And to reapproach that and come back to something that he wrote more than 25 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
And to come back to that and then to reinterpret it and put it on a record now in 2020. You know, who'd have thought something that he cooked up to like use in guitar clinics 25 years ago will end up on a record, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, another track that's just awesome. It's just really, really, really awesome.
It is. It's really a fun little, just there. A real fun, like a little snapshot into where John was and where John is now, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, and of course, we can't talk about that without talking about the amazing drumming as well in this particular track, which of course is courtesy of Mike Portnoy. It's badass. Really, really, really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'd be interested to find out what the dynamic was, whether John had like programmed some drums and Mike was just like the drummer, or whether there must have been a bit of that where John has obviously come up with what he has an idea for how the drums should be. Mike plays them, but also gets to kind of bring some of his style and what about this, what about that sort of thing. That must have happened.
It must have, I think, but it wouldn't surprise me if in some cases Mike just threw what John had out the window. And just sort like of went, what you about know what, this I can kind do better thing. Than this. Because there's definitely stuff in there that is not John. There's stuff in those drums that are not, because having heard, if you listen to Dramatic Turn of Events, right, all of those drums on that were actually programmed, given to Mangini, and Mangini played them note for note.
Yeah, played it basically straight up.
Basically,
it was like,
you know, although his exact words to me in an interview I did with him back in 2010 when it came out, was that I had to put some swing on it. I mean, I could have played it exactly like a robot, but, you know, I wanted to make sure it sounded natural. So, I'm sorry. You had to advance and retard notes because you're that fuck me.
Exactly.
You're that good. Excellent.
But you kind of have to. There's always going to be individual flair that's added to a thing. I remember
100%.
I remember there was an interview that was done with John Lord years ago when he was brought in to work on a George Harrison record. Mm-hmm. And he said that George Harrison's a relatively good piano player, and the piano parts he had come up for this record were quite simple block chord kind of things. And John Lord said to George Harrison, "He's like, what am I doing here? You could play this." And he's like, "Ah, no, you'll bring something to it. You'll bring something to it." Because, it's the same sort of thing. Sure, John Petrucci can program drums and they sound, they're going to sound pretty good, but you got to have the human element to it to make it sound that bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Which is something that is through this album as well with John. Not all of the solos are meticulously planned and such. There's some stuff in there that's kind of just thrown in. It's not haphazard. It's just sort of off the cuff, and it works really, really, really well. Now, next track 5, Out of the Blue.
This is the first song in what I'm going to refer to as like a couple of thought experiments. This first one, Out of the Blue, and then there's another one a bit later on. In this first thought experiment, we posit the question, what happened if there was an alternate universe John Petrucci that became a Cocktail Lounge guitar player? You know the type, low ceiling, man in the corner, playing the guitar to a broadly disinterested audience.
Mm.
What would the alternate universe John Petrucci of that look like? And I think this is the song he probably would have come up with.
Yeah,
it very much reminds me of a self-titled Joe Satriani album from 1995, where he more or less abandoned all the flashy solos and wacky guitar tones that he's known for, and played pretty much a Cocktail Lounge jazzy kind of record. This song is what that record was for Joe Satriani.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very bluesy, quite a nice change of pace from all the wacky guitar wizardry that's been going on in the first couple of songs. Mm. Although it does go into that at the end, which kind of reminded me of like Breaking All Illusions.
It started off, and
let's not make any bones about this. Breaking All Illusions is John Petrucci's allusion to La Via Strangiato by Rush, where it starts off all bluesy and then it just turns into a massive shred fest.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's that, or he's channeling Gilmore or something. It's phenomenal. One thing I do want to say about this particular section of the album too, this is my favorite tone of his on the album.
Okay.
Because it's not that – he's kind of gone from this beautiful, open, woody, lovely, not crazy over the top, gainy kind of shrill tone that he had in that sort of mid-90s era. The Score DVD, hands down, was his best live tone of any live tone that I've heard of his. It's just amazing. It's great. It was huge, thick. It was lush. It's great. But this is just a little bit sort of the tops are a little bit rolled off. It's just nice. It sits in the mix nicely. It's not like a lot of the stuff that he does now where it's just it's a great tone, don't get me wrong. And, there's a lot of people around who try and mimic that tone. I mean, they buy gear for it and, they try and play like him and so on and so forth. But I actually like this tone nicer. I don't know whether or not I'd necessarily say it suits him better, but it's, I think, more pleasurable to my ear to hear that kind of slightly rolled off, slightly less gainy, and just hearing the guitar breathe a little bit. It's nice. I really liked it.
Yeah, I don't think that sort of tone would necessarily suit like the Dream Theater sound in giant air quotes. And there's definitely like you hear stuff on this is the great thing about solo records. I mean, you hear stuff on Jordan Rudess's solo records that would never make a Dream Theater record in 1,000 years.
Mm.
Like some of that piano driven vocal stuff, like it doesn't really. That the way that he does it doesn't really fit the Dream Theater kind of sound. And similarly here, some of the guitar tones that John Petrucci has on this record definitely wouldn't fit a Dream Theater record.
Yes.
Like you couldn't do it. I don't think it'd work.
No.
Definitely there was some attempts on it at the Astonishing, but I've said enough about that record over the years and I don't think we need to go back over again.
We're putting that in the bag. And putting that down on the floor and not mentioning it. But I love this track because I think it shows, you know, I remember going to see him at a clinic in 2009 or 2008 or whatever it was. It was the Black Card Silver Linings Tour anyway.
2009, that would have been.
So, and he did a clinic at the Annandale Hotel, back when Annandale Hotel was good. And I remember this guy sitting next to me, and John was like, oh, so we got any questions from the audience? You know, I kind of want to make this like an interactive thing. So you ask me something and I'll tell you about it. The guy next to me was like, oh, play the Glass Prison. And
you could just about see John roll his eyes out of his 100%. Head when someone asked him for
and
that
it's
one.
Like, mate, he's got so much more variety than that. I mean, to me, you know, his most beautiful and his best solo that's not live, like a recorded one, is Lines in the Sand. You know, his best live solo is Hollow Years from Live at Budokan, closely followed by Lines in the Sand off Once in a Lifetime. You know, it just...
It's interesting when you talk about that kind of solo. I always think of, like, Take Away My Pain as another particularly good one
as
well.
Yeah, it's another fantastic one.
Even if you hear the original demo version, and Kevin Shirley kind of butchered it a little bit, but even the original one is really, really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I like the stuff where he plays a little bit simpler, not quite as shred-festy kind of stuff. You know, super melodic, and it's just... You know, it serves the song, and I love that. And I think that's what I love about this track, is that all the lead work just works. You know what I mean? It's not just him trying to sort of see how many notes he can fit into a bar. Not that I think that he necessarily does that, and he being him, he plays what suits the song, generally speaking, anyway.
Well, especially at this point in his career, he's got nothing left to prove to anybody. It's not like, you know, like, yeah, you look at some of the early stuff. You look at, like... Under a Glass Moon, for example. He freely acknowledges that was like his bag of tricks guitar solo. It's like they're all there. The whammy bar, the alternate picking, the sweeping, the tapping. It's all in there.
Yeah.
Every single one, all the guitar techniques, they're all sort of used one after the other in that solo.
Yeah.
Which, it's still very nice. It's still very good solo, but it's definitely like the bag of tricks solo.
Yeah, it's...
You
I've
don't
got to
see
admit, it's
that
not,
doing so much anymore.
It's not one of my favorite solos of his, though. Like, everyone always goes on about, oh, Glass Moon, Under a Glass Moon is a fantastic solo. Yes, technically... But it's not like a solo where I hear it and I go, wow. You know, like,
well, interestingly,
Yngwie
Malmsteen listened to, like, they did this thing where they stuck a blindfold on him for Guitar World magazine and they played him a bunch of stuff and they played that song for him. And he's like, ah, yes, I know this song well, Dream Theater, you know, very good band, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, you know, but you listen to the solo and you can just hear the bit that he's nicked from Steve Vai. You can hear the bit that he's nicked from Steve Morse. Yeah. And you can hear the bit that he's nicked from Aldo Miola or whatever.
Yep.
And he's like, but, you know, they're really good, talented musicians. And when they get kind of their sound together, they'll be really good. And that was him saying that in, like, the early 90s.
Yes. Yeah. And boy, did they get their sound together.
Oh, yes, exactly.
All right. We should move on, though.
Yes, we should.
Glassy-eyed zombies.
Now, apparently this song was written on a six string. I was watching a video earlier today out of Gear World, I think it was, a YouTube video. And apparently, because I heard this song and I thought, this must be a seven string. But apparently there's only one song on the record that comes out a seven string. So this is done on a six, which is interesting because I would have put money
like
down this was a seven. And that's interesting because I want to put money down. It sounds like a seven. Maybe it's like an alternate tuning sort of detuned, or it's a baritone or something.
I think it's definitely detuned. I don't think it's in E standard, but it's not a seven. It's not a seven string guitar.
Okay, okay. Because that main riff is very, very heavy, and maybe that's just me as like the untrained non guitar player that I am. I hear heavy. I think seven.
Well, I mean that opening riff is in. I think it's in E.
Is it?
I think so. I just strummed a chord over there. So it's
I was going to say, you got to grab your guitar and have a listen. Have a
I
play,
would
eh?
Suggest what he's probably done for this one for everyone playing along at home who's a guitarist. I'd suggest he's probably dropped his guitar down into D standard and then he's playing it on the second fret, like as if it's like it's an F sharp minor. Yes.
Oh, okay. I got maybe you. F sharp so minor. Like fifth, so like the fifth and the bass sort of thing. Yeah, where the fifth is below the root note and you put that in the bass, yeah?
No. I think he's probably just playing like on the second. He's just playing what would be an F sharp on a normal guitar.
But because you detune it to D, it becomes an E.
That's
okay,
right.
I gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. I'd suggest that's what he's doing. And I may know a thing or two about that because it might be a technique that I may or may not have nicked off him at a couple of times. So it's that's what it sounds like. It sounds like to me. It's not. It's definitely not. As I said, definitely not a seven string. But it's a. It's the same. I think it's the same playing position as damage control. I think. Probably not the okay. same notes, maybe. I don't know. Sound pretty close. But it's the same playing position, I think. So, you know, where you can go down to that, the low next note, which in this case would be D. So, yeah, that's what I think he's probably done yeah. there.
But the song itself is kind of a little bit more typical of what I was expecting to hear on John Petrucci's solo record. Mm-hmm. Like big, mad, complicated shredding, crazy riffs, and just like the interplay between John and Mike on guitar and drums.
Mm.
This song, and I think the next one, The Way Things Fall, are very much like what I was expecting to hear. So
I tend to agree with you. You know, there is a really, really big Dream Theater-y breakdown bit that sort of introduces the last third of the song. And you hear yeah. it, and you can hear Portnoy's drumming in it, and you can hear John, and it almost sounds like they're playing in the same room, although I know they weren't. Like it's atypical of a Dream Theater thing. Sorry, not atypical. It is typical of a Dream Theater song bit. Song line, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, when you put the two of them in a room, or when you put the two of them on a record together, rather, there's going to be, yeah, obviously in a room, that's not possible, but you put them in on a record together, you're going to get stuff that's like, ah, yes, that sounds like Dream Theater. Well, of course it does. For the longest time, for the, you know, 30-something odd years of the band, they were the sound of Dream Theater.
Well, yeah.
That guitar, drum, anyway, Mike Portnoy said that he would like, when he was coming up with his drum parts, he would always follow in with what John Petrucci was doing, less so than the traditional bass drummer kind of arrangement. Where you key in with what the bass guitar is doing.
Yeah,
he would very much follow what John Petrucci was doing, and then John Myung would either follow with what Jordan's left hand was doing or would follow along with what John Petrucci was doing.
That's right, yeah, which is really what makes them quite a unique sound.
Yeah.
So, all right, next track, The Way Things Fall. Now, you've got a little note here in the show notes that says, we delve further into things I expected to find on this record.
Yeah, these two songs, Glassy-Eyed Zombies and The Way Things Fall, kind of very much similar in just like a lot of things that I expected to find on this record.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
even the intro of The Way Things Fall, you've got that big, you know, that big open D chord, which is very reminiscent again of Lines in the Sand. And then there's that, you know, that hit, and then Mike comes in with the sort of thing, and you're like, yeah, okay, cool. This is a Dream Theater sort of esque thing. Yeah.
Yep, totally. So I don't really necessarily have anything to say about that song. It's not that it was a bad song. It's just that it was just kind of like something I expected to hear.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't like I have to listen to this and sort of figure out what's going to happen. You kind of knew because it was.
Yeah.
It's very typical of a John Petrucci thing. Really cool little breakdown section. You know, it is a nice thing. I mean, a lot of the solos in this particular album are basically, you know, all right, try and keep up. You know, sorry, I just thought of something. I thought of that scene from Back to the Future, you know, where Marty McFly's like, this is a blues riff and B, watch me for the changes and try and keep up. You know, just imagine John saying that to Mike. You know,
yeah,
it's a great song, very technical exercises kind of thing. I can see kids doing this for their HSC in 2 years' time.
Yeah, totally. Then we move on to the next song on the record, Snake in My Boot. Mm. Now, we talked about Out of the Blue being like alternate universe John Petrucci cocktail lounge guitar player. This song posits the question, what would happen in an alternate universe if John Petrucci ended up in Nashville wearing a Stetson? Because I don't know why, but there's just like a sort of country kind of bluegrass feel to the opening to this song. Am I going mad, Dave, or have I pretty much hit this one out of the park?
I'll tell you what, it's not quite a country bluegrass kind of thing. What it is, though, is it's what you're channeling, and the whole snake in my boot, you know, if he was wearing a big, you know, gallon hat and in Nashville and so on and so forth. What you're hearing is I Love Rock and Roll.
Ah.
You know, it's that real crunchy, awesome, you know, rock sound from the, you know, late 80s, early 90s.
So maybe not so much White country Snake. Or bluegrass, but definitely sort of like southern rock.
Yeah, yeah, I would say so, yeah. Quite a bit, you know, quite a bit more driven than a lot of that kind of stuff. But it's definitely that 80s, you know, Alice Cooper, White Snake. I don't know. I don't really listen to the stuff from that era, so I'm a little bit of at a loss. I know what it is, but I couldn't name you bands. It's great. It's got some fucking bullshit riffs in it, I'll tell you that much. You know. So there's one riff that starts at about 2 minutes 25, and it's just this awesome legato lick that is very Steve Vai, by the way. And it's huge. You listen to it and you go, oh, like that's the whole thing with this whole album is you listen to it and it's just technical prowess from cover to cover. It's, just, you know.
Yeah. It's kind of what you would expect though. Although I'm kind of interested in that there's no like song with John singing on it. Maybe that's not what people like what he wants to do with his solo stuff, but is it maybe he's just not that confident in his own voice doing lead vocals, which is probably why he doesn't do them at all.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe he just kind of goes, you know what, the guitar is my instrument. Because I know the reason why he learnt the guitar and got as good as he wanted to get on the guitar and so on and so forth was because he didn't want to ever have an idea in his head that he couldn't get out and he couldn't play. So I suggest that he's probably spent that long on those that, you know, he doesn't really have to do the other.
Because he can sing. I mean, there was that
the Wither cover.
Wither, yeah, yeah, the Wither, demo. Yeah, where he was singing it.
That was auto-tuned to shit. Yeah,
was it?
Oh, mate, it was so auto-tuned.
I'm assuming
it wasn't
that
funny.
The auto-tuning was there because he'd written it and then he it was like, oh no, I can't do the high notes sort of thing.
I think he wasn't locking into some of the notes as well. But maybe that has changed. I don't know.
Possibly. You know. I don't know.
Yeah. Either which way.
I know there was that, but yeah, I know there was that vocal demo of The Best of Times with Mike singing on it, which they played at his father's funeral and stuff like that.
Yes.
So, because Mike could sing. He does a really good job singing, I think.
He does. Well, he did backing vocals for quite some time.
For quite a long time,
and
yeah.
Now John does them, so.
Some of them, not all of them.
Yeah,
there are
true.
Definitely backing vocals that happen live that John is not singing.
Yeah,
and James isn't singing them either. So I don't know where they're coming from. They're coming from somewhere.
They're coming from the iPod.
They're coming from the iPod, or they're coming from the curtain backstage. Do not look behind the curtain. Do not look behind the curtain.
There's three James LaBrie clones out the back.
Yeah.
So, all right, final track on the album, Temple of Seradia?
I think that's how you say it.
Seradia?
Yeah. Now, this one is the lone seven-string song on the record.
Yes, it is.
Now, that opening riff, I was struggling to place it, and I'm like, I've heard something similar to this riff before. Where have I heard it?
Yep.
And then it popped into my head. It's like, aha, Bridges in the Sky.
100%. And later on when it goes into that bit, I was just like, yeah, that's very Bridges in the Sky.
Yeah, it's very Bridges in the Sky.
Which is fine. It's awesome. Like when you are an artist and you've been doing sort of the same thing, well, not the same thing, but you've been writing your own style for like 25, 30 years, you kind of get stuck into that style. And it becomes an identifiable thing. This is the same thing that John Fogerty had the problem with Fantasy Records.
Yes.
Which we've spoken about on the podcast before. You know, so you can't really blame him for doing that stuff. This is the track I want to learn off the album. It's this one. Because it's got this heavy groove.
Because you've become in recent possession of a 7-string now, haven't you?
Yes, a John Petrucci 7-string.
Yeah, even better.
And I feel like I've got to learn something of his, otherwise I don't deserve them.
Okay. If you haven't learned to play one of John Petrucci's 7-string songs on his 7-string guitar, what, they come and take it off you?
But listen, I didn't say that, all right? But they're probably listening, so, you know. Sterling Ball just kicks the door down. He's like, "Where's the guitar?
Give me the damn guitar!"
Yeah, sort of like the vegan police in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. But I think it's a great way to end the album. Like, this is just a balls to the wall, no holds barred, a great track to end the album.
Absolutely.
You know, it's great. It's very, very good. So, we're at the end of the album. What's your overall?
I mean, there are definitely things that I wouldn't necessarily expect to find on a John Petrucci record. There are definitely things that I did.
Mm.
I was not expecting to find the alternate universe John Petrucci Cocktail Lounge version or the alternate universe John Petrucci, like, Southern Rock guy.
Yeah.
Which is why I like this record. It's not, you know, you can see there are some artists that do a solo record and it's like, yes, okay, we know that this was just kind of done like through the mail with a bunch of people and you've got the thing and you just solo over the top of it. There's nothing super interesting or in depth or different things stylistically. This one has this record.
Mm.
You have that on this record. You have the different styles. You have the different interpretations of sort of genres and styles of guitar playing. So it's a very, very good record.
Yes, I agree with you. It's a fantastic album. It's long awaited, and I think it's long deserved. It is a great, great album. I very, very, very much enjoyed it. And it's great to hear John doing his thing again, sort of just, you know, shredding out. I think it's going to be another one of those albums that's going to stand the test of time like his first one did. And I think it's a great, great thing to hear.
I think also as well in like the solo albums, I think it's sort of like less is more. I mean, there are two of them that span his entire career.
Mm.
If it was like a solo record thing that kind of got pumped out once every 3 years, I don't think everything on it would necessarily be all that great.
Agree.
The fact that they're so far out in space and time, it makes them kind of better.
Yes, agreed. 100%. Yeah.
Also, it also doesn't hurt that Dream Theater basically busted out a record every 2 years since the mid-2000s. So, you know.
Yeah.
There's no shortage of like John Petrucci writing that has ended up on Dream Theater Records as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of that, the album review. And now I think it's time for our album reviews.
So the record that I gave to you was by an Australian band, it was Prophecy by Ironstone.
Yes.
So what did you think of this record, Dave?
I thought it was a really cool EP. I know there's like 6 or 7 tracks on it or something, but it's like 26 minutes. So, you know, it's not an album.
It's an EP.
It sounds like a cross between Carnival and Periphery with like Indian elements thrown in.
Okay.
It was really, really, really cool. The mix left a little touch to be desired. The vocals were a bit forward, in my opinion. But it's definitely a great album. These guys, I think, are ones to watch. I think it's going to be a really, really interesting interesting band to have a captain at in the future. It's about all I have to say about it, to be really honest with you. It was enjoyable, and I think it's going to be one of those albums that I sporadically come back to.
Fair enough.
Now, I gave you Telegy's Black Swallow. Now,
what I was going to say, this particular record, now, this reminded me very much of another record you gave me to review, which the name of which escapes me. You'll be able to help me out. You were the one who gave me to it. The one about the lady cop who was trying to find the one who killed the partner. And it was like, piece of story, piece of music.
The one from this year was Beyond by Hibernal.
Yes, that's the one.
Hibernal
was
the artist, but the album that you're talking about is The Dark of the City.
Yes, that's the one. Same structure. Piece of story, piece of music. Mm. Piece of story, piece of music. Kind of like sort of like musical theater in a kind of way. Mm. The difference between that album and this one is that was a fictional story. This is a mostly true. Well, I say mostly. It's like it's based on a true story on the person's life. Mm. Eugene Bullard was an African-American who fled America, ended up in France, flew for them in World War One, which is where the Black Swallow come from, because he flew in a division of the French Air Force that was known as the Swallows of Death.
Yes.
And then he was involved in the resistance movement in World War II. Then he came back to America and then got the shit kicked out of him when he went to a concert by a communist sympathizer. Shit kicked out of him by the police as well. You can see why this album was made this year. It's like, this is a remarkably prescient album for today's current political climate. Although when it comes to race relations in America, history has a bad habit of repeating itself many, many times throughout history.
No.
And the story of Eugene Bullard is no exception.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite the cast of musicians that can be that performed on this record. Mm. Pete Chihuahua's featured on this record. Dave Moreau's featured on this record. Tony Levin played the upright bass on this record. So highly recommended. Everyone should listen to this record.
Yeah.
Everyone should go and have a read of the story. I spent a rather enjoyable afternoon going through the backstory of Eugene Bullard and finding out about all the different things. And I'm no war or history buff, but this story, the story and the story of his life is very, very interesting. So
it's extremely interesting, and it's very sad as well. You know,
he was like a war hero in France and then came back to America and was virtually unknown.
Absolutely. And ostracized because of the color of his skin.
Yes. And the people that he hung out with as well.
Yes.
You know, being seen to be with communist sympathizers and shit. Yeah. Just, ugh.
I know. Just unbelievable.
Indeed. Right. So what have you got for me this time around, Dave?
All right. So this week I have a brand new prog album for you. It came out 5 days ago at time of recording. It is called Auto Reconnaissance by The Tangent. So I'll pop a link to that in the show notes and you can have a bit of a listen to that. What have you got for me?
So we spoke earlier about Fate's Warning and the new Fate's Warning record that is on its way out. I'm going to give you a Fate's Warning record to listen to, but probably not the one you're thinking of. The one that I'm going to pick is actually a favorite of my wife's and a favorite of mine as well. It's called FWX.
Okay.
It's from 2004.
All right.
Have a listen to that one and tell me what you think.
I will do. Awesome. Well, I think that about wraps it up for this evening. It's been a blast talking about the brand new John Petrucci album and talking about a whole bunch of other stuff as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Where can the good people find us and talk to us, Hoggy?
You can find the links for the show notes for this episode at the98podcast.fireside.fm/61. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM. And if you follow the link in the show notes, we'll take you to the contact form on our website and you can send us an email and tell us all the reasons why we were right and or wrong about this particular John Petrucci record.
Mm.
Love to get feedback from our listeners and love to start conversations and if there's like local music that's happening in your area that you want us to have a listen to, by all means, send it in. We love receiving that kind of feedback from everybody.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode, the 61st episode of the 98 Podcast. My name is Dave Ellis.
My name is Alex Hogg. We'll see you all next time.
See you then. Stay safe.